Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Reason Podcast is where I speak to Reason's senior editors today, Nick Gillespie, Catherine Mangu Ward, and Peter Suderman, to get their thoughts on news of the day. Then I steal their opinions and I regurgitate them at cocktail parties to sound smarter and encourage you to do the same. Hello, gang. How are you?
Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Andrew.
Morning.
Good morning. Well, unfortunately, today some of the stories are both heavier and sadder. We're going to talk about how your portfolio would fare in a nuclear crisis with North Korea, the infamous Google memo, and lamentably, white supremacy rearing its ugly head in Virginia, which dominated the news over the weekend and is perhaps a watershed event going forward. Over the weekend, things went from bad to terrible in Charlottesville, Virginia. Friday night, a group of white nationalists grabbed torches and marched through Charlottesville to protest the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. And the following day, they held a Unite the Right rally there, which was met by counter-protesters. And violence broke out between the two groups, culminating in a alleged Nazi sympathizer plowing his car into the crowd, which has killed one woman and injured 19 others. On Saturday afternoon, President Trump condemned the egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides, but he didn't call out white supremacy. Nick, this is terrible, of course. This is absolutely awful what happened. Is this a blip of something terrible that occurred, or is this something ominous that hearkens to a watershed moment?
I hope it's not the latter, but I fear that it is, for the simple reason that political violence in the United States, while far below what was taken for granted really in the 70s and to some degree in the early 80s, you know, it is starting to make a comeback. And I'll say this about Donald Trump's carefully worded disgust with political violence. He talked about it on many sides. He refused, as you noted, to actually say that there was something un-American about people carrying Nazi flags, you know, near or on the campus of the University of Virginia. And he was trying to say, you know, there's a lot of violence out there. It's on all sides. He clearly was either afraid or was cautiously refusing to call out, you know, neo-Nazis. I mean, literally people who are carrying Nazi flags. And that, I think, is problematic, and it's not going to stop anything, or it's not going to halt anything. In fact, a couple of white nationalist, ethno-nationalist, neo-Nazi groups had said, oh yeah, Trump was definitely signaling to us with that. The problem here is that, of course, protest, you know, peaceful demonstrations, protests are very American, and it's also very American to allow them. But there is something fundamentally screwed up when you have a president who is afraid to call out neo-Nazis, you know, because we're not talking about people who are, you know, merely, you know, saying in pleasant terms, you know, that they're getting they're not getting a fair shake in contemporary America or anything like that. I mean, people carrying swastikas. This is fucked up beyond belief. And what I tend to see it, though, more as an effect, not a cause of what's been going on. And I've been harping on the idea of the United States moving from a high trust to a low trust or a lower trust country. And I think this is part and parcel of it. I don't think it will be a watershed event in this sense that you see within the Republican Party. And, you know, we need to be clear here that when we're talking about right-wing identity politics, we are talking about the Republican Party, and they have hearkened on a line about how, you know, effectively saying that white men have no rights that need be respected. There is a sign that, you know, that is running its course among Republican higher-ups. And I think somebody like Senator Jeff Flake, a senator from Arizona, who's got a new book out, Conservative of Conscience of a Conservative, which harkens back to Barry Goldwater, he is calling out his party first and foremost for, first off, being ineffective at governing all of their legislative priorities about right-sizing the size, scope, and spending of government. They failed on, but also they have been particularly incendiary in their rhetoric. And I think it comes to this. And that's not to excuse left-wingers and progressives like the Antifa people who go around punching people without any provocation. We need a president who will, and it's mind-numbing for me to say this, both as somebody who, you know, who watches documentary, or just saw Dunkirk, for Christ's sake, and whose father fought in World War II, but to be in the 21st century and have a president of the United States who's afraid to call out Nazis, That's a fucked up situation, to say the least.
So, Nick, you said you thought that maybe Trump was afraid to say this. I mean, do we think that it's actually that Trump is nervous or anxious about doing this, or that this is a fairly consistent part of how Trump approaches these groups? I mean, if you go back about a year ago, this is, you know, he refused several times on CNN to disavow David Duke, a white supremacist leader, did eventually do so in a sort of grudging, offhanded way. I disavow, you know, a few days later. But this has been a big part. I mean, maybe not a big part, but this has been a consistent part of how Trump has treated these groups. He's really been extremely wary of calling them out. And it's really amazing, I think, this is someone who calls out everyone by name. And he is the loosest talking president you can imagine, and also the most quick to just go in and name someone and sort of, you know, and insult them directly and to belittle them. And he would not hear, and he would not, it's not just that he wouldn't in his initial statement. The White House was given several opportunities to follow up, do you explicitly, you know, want to call out white supremacy and the KKK and neo-Nazis here? And the White House said on multiple occasions following up on Saturday after the violence, the president has been very clear. He disavows violence on all sides and just wouldn't do it. Eventually, another statement did come out attributed to just an anonymous senior White House official that, of course, Trump's condemnation includes white supremacists, KKK, neo-Nazi, and all extremist groups. But Trump himself has not said it. And Trump, we have not gotten this out of any named official or out of the president's mouth in any real way.
I agree with you. And also, to make matters worse, in a press conference that he gave over the weekend, which was ostensibly about some veterans affairs legislation that he signed, he managed to work in one of his main slogans in the campaign, which is that, you know, we have no room for this. We are all Americans first. So he was hearkening back to the America First campaign theme of his or the theme of his campaign. And I think, you know, this is something that as a libertarian, I take seriously the idea that I am simultaneously a citizen of America and a citizen of a particular state, town, locality, but also a citizen of the world. And that the whole kind of, and I don't think that Trump is racist. I don't think he's a member of the KKK or is a secret Nazi or anything like that. But he does see the world in these kind of globalist versus nationalist tendencies. And that gives rise, I think, particularly in the company that he keeps, to a kind of ethno-nationalism, which is very, it's not the same thing as, you know, as Richard Spencer and calling for an, you know, ethno-nationalist enclaves in, you know, the mountains of the interior West or anything. But it's simpatico with it in a way that, you know, political violence has its own, you know, the people who commit political violence are responsible for political violence. But I would like to see a president, and I would like to see an elected class in America that can understand that the idea of Trump, of pushing ethno-nationalism as a meaningful concept is not just wrong, but it has never been more wrong in human history, and it has always been wrong in America. And it has a long, sordid history in America, but the whole idea about America is that anybody can be an American. This is, you know, at odds with historical reality, but it is also, you know, part and parcel of the philosophical ideas behind America. And it's troubling beyond belief to, you know, even be discussing this type of stuff, which did lead to, you know, the death of somebody, as well as, you know, a couple of police officers or law enforcement officers who were in a helicopter that were going to the event, which crashed.
So this is terrible. We're all, I think, surprised that it's this awful. I'm surprised that there are this many people that identify as white nationalists and white supremacists. I kind of thought we had put that to rest. Catherine, is this phenomenon, are these people coming out from the shadows, and are they emboldened, or is this something new where the movement itself is growing? What's going on?
I think we need to believe the people themselves who say, at least some of them say, that they are emboldened by the election of Donald Trump. They say that they feel like they have a friend in the White House, and that makes them want to come out and stand up for what they believe in. I still do think it's important to keep in mind that this is a tiny, tiny number of people. There were a much larger number of counter-protesters in Charlottesville itself, and then, of course, many, many gatherings around the country of counter-protests later in the day and later in the weekend. We are not a country of white nationalism. We aren't. And anyone who is pretending that we are is hyping up the wrong problem, I think. The fact that we can't apparently have a civil debate about whether or not we should have a statue to Robert E. Lee in the town square is a huge issue. The fact that a few jerks are running around with Nazi flags absolutely should be condemned in the strongest possible terms, including ideally by the president, but it's not representative of the nation. And I do think people know that, but it's hard to keep perspective on that when someone has just died as a result of violence, apparently inflicted by a person who held Nazi beliefs as far back as high school. So that's I guess it's not a call for calm, because I don't think we should particularly be calm, but it is a call for perspective. And in particular, perspective on the issue of free speech, which we can talk about a little bit later if you want to, Andrew.
Well, no, actually, I'd like to get into that, because you wrote a piece on that this morning, Catherine, at least I think it was this morning, where you were highlighting the difference between assault, which is illegal, violence is illegal, and speech, which is legal. And hate speech has no legal distinction within our country. I think we're all proponents of freedom of speech on the podcast, oftentimes to the chagrin of friends who probably aren't as much philosophically on board with that. But I kind of want to play devil's advocate with you. Most other countries have some kind of limit on the boundaries of speech that they're willing to tolerate. Germany probably has the most restrictive within the developed world, because you can't say anything that's pro-Nazi. You can't do a Sieg Heil or anything like that. You would literally be jailed for that. In the UK, there's boundaries where beyond a certain pale, it's considered not just inappropriate, but illegal. I look at the UK and Germany, and I don't feel like the average citizen should be worried about their opinions being stifled by virtue of these outer bounds. What are your thoughts?
I think the average citizen should be worried. I once heard a funny story from Michael Moynihan, formerly of Reason, now of Vice, who said that when he lived in Sweden, when people were arrested, they used to like demand their rights, because they had seen so many American police procedurals that they thought they had rights they didn't really have. America's model of rights-bearing citizenry is the model for the world. And sure, we can all say, yeah, well, Germans, I get it. They're a little touchy about the Nazi thing. But the fact is, to say no free speech for fascists, which was on many a protest sign this weekend, is to say no free speech for Muslims. And I really don't think that's an overstatement. I think if you are saying people who we suspect among their number, a subculture that we suspect who among their number has someone somewhere who is willing to do violence against people they disagree with, should have their speech rights curtailed, which, as far as I can tell, is exactly what people are saying about these fascists in Charlottesville. They are saying, if you are a big group of people and one of you hits someone with your car, everybody loses their speech rights. It's the exact same argument as saying, if you are a big group of people and one of you is a suicide bomber, all of you lose your speech rights. And we cannot have that. We simply cannot. And I think that that is a real risk in the United States.
I agree with you, Catherine, both on the particular point that white nationalists, like Antifa people, anti-fascist people, like extreme left-wingers, are a very small proportion of the population, and we need to absolutely keep that in mind. And also that free speech needs to be protected. It's not an original insight, but it's particularly for people who are in who are making very unpopular and oftentimes really ugly speech. At the same time, for me, the inability of Donald Trump as president, as somebody who, I mean, for God's sake, this guy needs a sister soldier moment, where he calls out people who are close to him or a part of his constituency, which seems to be the case. And that is, it's not simply for this particular cause. I mean, we, you know, within recent memory, we saw or heard reports of people on Evergreen State College campus actually, you know, policing the campus after a big blow up over a Whites Get Out Day with baseball bats and essentially threatening people. That is not speech. You know, immediate threats of physical violence. You know, that's aggression that should not be tolerated. And the biggest problem, I think, in America now is that we are at a moment where we have two major political parties, neither of which can really win a presidential majority. And the polarization of rhetoric and the hardening of rhetoric is problematic. And for me, one of the negative outcomes of all of this is that it legitimates the kind of left-wing or progressive response and extreme response, which is also at times violent. And we need to, this is like a pathetic plea, but we need to regain that, it's in the center, but it's not moderate, which is a radical defense of free speech and of free expression, while also, you know, pushing more towards the center and drawing more people into a common belief that American society is multicultural, is multi-ethnic, is constantly changing, is both simultaneously nationalistic as well as cosmopolitan or globalist. And one of the problems with Donald Trump is that he seems to have the shortest time horizon of any president, where he doesn't give a shit about what's happening in 15 minutes, much less what's happening in 15 years. And I feel he's surrounded by people like Stephen Miller who don't care. They don't care about the next election even yet, because that's 3 years away or whatever. And I find it, I agree with you completely, but I really feel like if the president of the United States is supposed to be a leader in anything, it would be that they can actually set the terms of debate in a way that is beneficial rather than just totally screwy.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I mean, one of his points throughout the campaign was his perceived failure of President Obama and Secretary Clinton from saying extreme radical terrorism. But that was something he brought up again and again and again. So he's clearly aware of the significance of phraseology and identification and seems to be tiptoeing around it, which is indeed terrible. One of the criticisms that's being levied against Charlottesville is that this protest happened at all and that it escalated as far as it did. I think the authorities in Charlottesville, from what I can tell, are basically saying that No shots were fired, and there's no way they could have foreseen a car going in and killing somebody, so that they did what they could. Peter, did they handle this correctly by sending out people with riot gear and trying to prepare for something bad? Should they have done something different?
So I think these are difficult decisions for local authorities, for police, when they encounter protest events like this. I mean, on the one hand, we have seen car-based attacks before. This is something that ISIS has done that we have seen on rare occasions, I believe, in the United States. But it's not something that's super common. You know, but sort of in a larger, the bigger picture here, part of allowing free speech and part of protests is allowing people to get near each other, allowing emotions to get heated, allowing people to yell at each other. Free speech isn't always sort of calm and pretty and nice looking. And so that, of course, you know, sort of in some ways it can look like it is edging up to violence, but not actually get there. And so this is a difficult thing, I think, for authorities to think about and to deal with. And it's just sort of, you know, you have to, in some sense, allow those heated emotions to come out and people to express them. And you have to allow people to get near each other in certain cases, because that is part of the protest and counter-protest kind of cycle of conversation. And as long as it is not breaking it into violence, then in some sense, you know, the authorities need to be careful about whether or not they're going to intervene and whether or not they're going to, you know, sort of how much they're going to attempt to shape and control what crowds are doing and saying and how they are behaving.
Nick, the instigating event or the instigating factor of all of this was Charlottesville removing a statue of Robert E. Lee, a big general in the Confederacy. This is something that Reason's covered before, although, of course, in this situation, it's justifiably overshadowed by the violence that's taking place. But the arguments in favor of it are racism, the Confederacy, things like that. And on the flip side, where do we stop in terms of uprooting history? Do you think Charlottesville should take the statue down?
That's for them to decide. I'm not a fan of memorials to people who committed treason against the United States. But it's also, you know, it's that, I mean, if something is a local issue, I would think that its statuary is probably the case. And, you know, more important, the point is that, you know, the South, broadly speaking, has been going through a reevaluation of the Confederate past, which is what we're talking about here. And different states and different towns have taken different approaches. I think that, you know, that works best because it actually deals with the local issues, whether or not, you know, there's a reason why the United States does not have a federal holiday commemorating, you know, the Confederate. You know, the Confederacy, I don't think that that makes much sense. But it's also understandably, it's not to say it's a sore spot in American history is to really undersell, you know, the issues at you know, in conflict during the Civil War and the legacy since then. One of the things that I'm a big believer in is understanding the where a lot of the statue, a lot of the commemoration of the Confederacy comes from. And one of the most important things to realize is that it didn't come necessarily even in the 19th century, but it was more in the 20th century, first during what was called the Southern Cultural Revival in the teens and 20s and 30s. Kind of the high water mark of that was the publication of the novel and then the premiere of the movie Gone with the Wind. And you can look around in many parts of the South, where a lot of the things that we identify with as a kind of Confederacy pride actually came into being relatively recently, even past World War II, and the introduction of the Confederate battle flag as a kind of marker of Southern tradition, that's very tied tightly to anti-segregation efforts in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. And knowing that, I think, is more important than anything else. We should live with our history, but we should also recognize that our understanding of history changes in response to the way that people change. And so that's, you know, I could yammer on yes or no. I don't, you know, I've been to Charlottesville twice in my life. I don't pretend to tell people what statues should be there. By the same token, we shouldn't be mistaken in what the Confederacy was in favor of, and in its what's called the Keystone Speech, or the Cornerstone Speech, excuse me, by the Vice President of the Confederacy, said that the South was fighting for the perpetuation of slavery. Make no doubt about it. Every secession document that was written in the run up to the Civil War stated that slavery was an essential right. And, you know, that's wrong. And it should be understood as wrong.
Yeah. And I'll add to that, that I don't think we should celebrate losers. I agree with everything you said. And I think a lot of the time that historical element is definitely used to shroud things. On a related statuary note, in Oklahoma, we had a Ten Commandments monument on the state capitol lawn up until last year. And one of the arguments was that it's historical, even though I think we put it up in 2004 or something like that. Peter, next week there's going to be free speech rallies around the country in response to not this, but to the Google memo that we'll talk about here shortly. And we can anticipate there being, I think, some overlap between the alt-right who bolstered the James Damore, who wrote the Google memo. Do you think Charlottesville is going to be energizing or sobering? What's going to happen next at the next protest?
I think people's emotions are going to be running pretty high, understandably, correctly even. I think that what we're going to sort of – I mean, I very much hope that we do not see any more violence come out of this. I also think that that it is possible that we have – that this does presage more violence or at least more conflict between between – you know, sort of the couple of sides here that are kind of arguing with each other. And I think that, you know, authorities are going to be extremely sensitive to this and are going to be aware. And, you know, again, my hope is that we don't see any more violence and that people can learn to speak to each other without going any further than that. And that, you know, if we can sort of come back to that, look, the lesson here is not that what we need is more violence. It's not that what we need is more physical conflict. The lesson here is that we need to learn to talk to each other better, and that our political leaders, frankly, need to show a little more spine in sort of setting the tone and in denouncing ideas that have no place in America.
I think you're right, and hopefully that will be the case. It would be great if both Republicans and Democrats would get on board with the idea that white supremacy and white nationalism are terrible and not emblematic of our values as a people and should not be considered constituents of either camp. And it would likewise be the hope of everyone at Reason that any future protests that happen aren't violent. And particularly this weekend, because there are several rallies and protests scheduled around the country. Now, these are not in response to the tragedy in Charlottesville, although I suspect that there will be some dealing with that. These were already planned as of last week in response to a infamous Google memo that was circulated around. Now, fortunately, with this story at least, there hasn't been any violence. So we're de-escalating from the clash of evil supremacists and kind of getting into a different camp of some alt-right, but also some freedom of speech issues, at least on a cultural level. Last week, an employee at Google named James Damore wrote an internal memo positing that the tech giant's disproportionate amount of men to women isn't a result of sexism, but it's a manifestation of cognitive differences between men and women. And he said specifically that men are more likely to go into mechanical fields that are less personal, i.e. coding, whereas women are more likely to go into personal fields, which would not include coding. And that really, Google should, rather than having a proactive diversity policy, should just sort of acknowledge that there's going to be a difference in the number of men and women just as a result of this.
If I can interrupt, Andrew, I think that's actually a misrepresentation of what he actually wrote. He talked about how, you know, among other things, that he believed in diversity. And, you know, maybe he's just saying that for rhetorical effect, but he said that there may be various explanations for it, which include cultural ones, which include biological or genetic ones and predispositions. But, you know, one of the things, even if he said what you were saying, you know, that I think, you know, you need to be able to talk about that kind of stuff. But it's actually, I think, pretty interesting and pretty important that the critics of him basically oftentimes without reading the document basically came to that he was saying, you know, he was making some kind of hardwired determinist argument about why a particular company in Silicon Valley in the 21st century has a really shitty record of hiring women and keeping women. You know, it wasn't that actually. It was a much more nuanced and I think credible argument that deserves a kind of clear summary before we talk about why it's incendiary.
Oh, sure. And I mean, you're right. I think the memo he wrote and the four of us on this podcast might be the only people in the country that actually read the memo because the headlines that are responding to it are, you know, Google employee goes off on anti-diversity screed. I think that was the Gizmodo headline. There were several like that. Social media was even less favorable and less fair, in my opinion. So I think you're right. I think he in the memo, he went out of his way to try and establish that he didn't think that women were worse or incapable of any of the jobs that men do. But my takeaway was that he was kind of questioning the assumption of sexism at Google, that was something that he thought that they were sort of unnecessarily beating themselves up about, and that he thought they should be able to have a conversation about it. And my question for you, Nick, is that I look at this as Damore saying we can't have an open conversation at Google because of political correctness, and then Google subsequently firing him because he's politically incorrect. Is that the case? Is it more complex than that? And do you think Google was justified in doing so?
I don't know about Google because I don't know about their code of conduct exactly. There was a lot of kind of weasel words and back and forth where, you know, both personnel directors as well as or diversity vice presidents as well as the head of Google himself saying that, you know, parts of the document went beyond what is allowable at Google based on a corporate code of conduct. Didn't specify what those parts were, which would have been extremely helpful. Different polls, purporting to be of Google employees, said that, you know, a lot of people or nobody agreed with Damore in his sense that Google lives in an echo chamber, an ideological echo chamber. So, I mean, there are a lot of things to think about that. I wrote a piece talking about how the inability to kind of have any discussion about this is problematic. And it's beyond a question of free speech, because you can hold, I think, a lot of different opinions about this that on the face of it may not seem to square up. But one is that Damore has a right to, you know, say what he thinks, and we need to be able to have open discussions about why there is not always numerical parity in any particular institution or field or arena of activity. Google could be completely within its rights as a company to fire whoever it wants if these people are at-will employees, and if the state of California allows for that at-will employment, essentially means that both the employee and the employer can terminate people without having without needing cause to say you've done this, you've done that, et cetera. Those two things can be happening completely, independent of one another, that Damore has a right to talk about it. Or as a society, we need to be able to have open conversations about diversity and its outcomes and attempts to instill it that fail, which is what's been going on at Google. It's currently under a lawsuit for sexist practices. And then there's a third version, which in talking with Wally Olson, I did an interview with Wally Olson that's up at the Reason podcast. Wally Olson is a legal analyst at the Cato Institute. And he talked about the ways in which the expansion of hostile workplace environment hostile environment in the workplace, pushed by the federal government and upheld by various courts, actually changes the ability of people to have any kind of free speech in the workplace in a way that is disturbing and problematic. And that's another issue at play here. Is the fact, like people will say, and a lot of libertarians will say, look, it's a private company. Google's a private company. They can do whatever they want in their own workplace. But in fact, the federal government has kind of moved in, and various state governments have moved into the workplace in ways that actually squelches free speech in a pretty powerful way. So, I mean, there's a lot of different things going on here. And it's to ask, like, should Google have the right to fire him? I think in a perfect world, yes. Should we be having a conversation about the abilities of people? Like, how do you know if you have a level playing field? When disparities are huge, when is that acceptable? How do we deal with that as a society? I think that's a different discussion, which is also really important and far more important than what happens at Google. And then there's this other question about how the federal government, without actually pushing directly, is able to change the way that workplace kind of autonomy is allowed, which is also problematic. Yeah,
I think you're right. And I also think that as libertarians, we oftentimes get into a habit of just sort of avoiding conversations if it happens in the private sphere. Like I saw this with the United case, where United had the guy that they beat up on the plane, where a lot of us were like, well, it's a private entity. We don't really want to deal with this. Whereas, you know, they were terrible. I think with Google, I think you and Shiki Dalmia had kind of taken opposite tacks, where she was a little bit more condemnatory of Google and you're a little bit more sympathetic to their, what they're doing within the company. Catherine, I want to turn to you. You are a woman. And I'm curious as to if you think there are cognitive differences that manifest between male and female females in an office. Do you think there's anything to that? Is that are we all the same? There's social constructs. Is there actual biological directives that compel people to work differently?
A person who had a really good take on this was Megan McArdle, who is also Mrs. Peter Suderman. So he can recuse himself here or chime in as he prefers on his wife's views about gender roles. I think that sounds like a trap.
I think of myself as Mr. Megan McArdle.
Well, there you go. Hashtag feminism.
Cuck.
She basically wrote a piece about being a woman working in tech and saying that she, you know, was good at the work and was able to do it, but she wasn't passionate about it. And the anecdote that she told was about some one of her colleagues over the weekend, spending the weekend wiring up his basement for some kind of elaborate workstation thing that I can't even say the right words to describe, probably because of my uterus. And, you know, the sort of his enthusiasm for that task compared with her lack of enthusiasm, even as she possessed aptitude for it. And I think that's a distinction that's been lost a little bit in the discussion about this Google memo. In his effort to be comprehensive, Damore managed to undermine his own case. If he had focused on any of the sub points that he made, I think he could theoretically have been much more compelling, particularly the points about interest. If he had just said, let's completely leave aside the aptitude question and just talk about whether or not it is consistent with people's own expressed desires to have a 50-50 mix in Google's workplace, he would have had stronger ground to stand on, I think, because that's also a place where libertarians should be able to agree. You know, if people want to choose to go into careers in different, you know, gender mixes, that is not necessarily a sign that something is horribly wrong. Now, A, sexism is real. B, discrimination is real. C, stupid laws about discrimination that prevent people from talking about it in an honest way are totally real. But, you know, I think that memo to me read like a bunch of dumb Reddit conversations. And if he had managed to tailor the points, be a little more selective in the information that he cited, and be less kind of all-encompassing, he might have actually gotten a bit further. Maybe not. Maybe the workplace culture is now so incredibly poisonous that even saying any of the words in that memo basically gets you booted. Though I would totally second Nick's point that Wally Olson and also before him, Jonathan Rauch, have done amazing work about how the restrictions on speech in the workplace are sort of an unremarked upon dramatic curtailing of what people are and are not allowed to say in the United States.
Well, Catherine, can I ask, as you know, the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, there's also just a kind of internal question of communications. And I don't have any knowledge of whether or not or what forums Google provides for employees to kind of, you know, talk about large issues that directly affect the company. But there is that kind of propriety where, you know, did he go through proper channels? And could you imagine a moment, and I realize I'm about to chill the speech of your staff as well as probably mine, but where somebody says something that you might agree with or is very provocative, but because they say it in such a way within your organization, you're like, what the fuck is wrong with you? And, you know, this is not the right way to stage a conversation. And you might not fire somebody, but you would remonstrate them somehow.
I'm pretty sure that's already happened on this podcast. So it's already done. No, I mean, of course, also being socially appropriate in a general sense is something that everyone looks for in an employee. And it is arguably socially inappropriate to write a 10-page memo about, you know, gender relations at a company that has a stated culture to increase the number of women in the workplace, right? Like, you could just say, that's it, it's simple enough, fire the guy. But I would like to think that we could theoretically live in a slightly different universe than the one we live in now, where that conversation could be productively had and we could get something out of it.
One of the things that I've seen in response to all of this is a tremendous amount of outpouring on social media and from blogs and articles about how this is a just straight up either an attack on diversity or borderline sexist or at best tone deaf. I'm kind of bothered by the sort of increasing Orwellian two-minute hate we seem to have as a people, where there's sort of an electric fence, and if somebody touches it, we all gang up and want them to lose their livelihood and that kind of thing. Peter, do you think the response to Damore has been proportional to what he did?
Well, I think the response feels much more intense when you spend all or much of your day on social media. And now increasingly, of course, that's where people spend their time, but it's not where everyone does. And there are a lot of people who are fairly disconnected from it. And you just sort of to make a larger sort of a broader point, this is one of the reasons why Trump's numbers have done, I think, in some ways as well as they have, is because a lot of his supporters are not on social media seeing Trump's tweets and seeing the kind of constant invective, you sort of the debates. They're not part of that. That's not part of their world. And so you can avoid a lot of this stuff just by staying off or limiting your access to social media. That said, a lot of us do live there. A lot of us do spend that time. And so these cultural flashpoints are just people are going to gravitate towards them, and people are going to talk about them, and they're going to talk about them in many cases in extremely strong, heated, passionate language. And so what you're going to, I mean, this is just sort of the nature of online conversation, is that it allows these sort of these moments, it gives them, how do I say it? It's more sort of tinder for, you know, to burn. And because there's a lot more people who now can comment and can participate. And I think in general, that's a good thing for the kind of national conversation about, you know, sort of who we are and what we do. On the other hand, it also means that at times people are going to the majority of people are going to just be focusing on one or two or a few things. And that's going to create, some fairly intense discussion. But as long as it's limited to the, you know, sort of to the level of discussion, I mean, that to me seems like a good and productive thing. And we're able to have these conversations, I think, you know, sort of in some ways faster and perhaps hopefully in the long run, even more productively than we would otherwise.
When you said, Peter, it's just more Tinder, for a minute, I had this full-fledged vision of a social, like a dating network, but for political outrage. And I think it could work, actually. So if anybody wants to go in with me on that startup idea.
I think if you can combine political outrage with sex, we could make a lot of money.
I mean, we just did. Right there. Heaton, you want to quit this podcast? And
my Kickstarter is live now.
Damn it. Suderman.
Well, now is it so it's just the hate fuck network where you just bring people together and they call it the gloryhole.com.
Please stop. I take it all back.
If I can say though, this is I think a serious problem, not in terms of, it's always great that people have more avenues of expression and that they feel, you know, empowered to express themselves. One of the issues I think in contemporary America is that, and if you take the presidential race as a kind of shorthand for it, you have somebody like Hillary Clinton, who is leading a kind of progressive faction in America, a kind of democratic progressive faction, who cannot get 50% of the vote. You have somebody like Donald Trump, who is leading a populist Republican, a populist conservative faction, who gets even fewer votes. And what is bizarre about that, and this is something that Morris Fiorina, a political scientist at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, has written a lot about, is that when you look at where most Americans are on many, if not all, major kind of social issues, as well as a lot of policy issues, there is a broad either majority out there or a large plurality that believes in things like, you know, that sexism is bad, that individuals should be treated as individuals, that believe in some form of affirmative action, or at least, not in terms of rigid quotas, but of trying to make up for historical injustices, things like that. A large majority of people are okay with the way abortion laws are written now. A majority wants school choice. A majority wants drug legalization. There is no party that gives voice to the mass number of people who really are socially liberal and economically conservative, for lack of a better term. And I'm not saying that America is all libertarian or anything like that, but what I'm saying is that we have a political rhetoric where if you are in favor, and we all know this from every conversation we have with people in the media and most of our friends, if you say, I believe in pot legalization and lower taxation, you're looked at as if you're, like from another planet or something like that. And in fact, that is the new, American consensus, but we don't really have a way of talking about it or bringing it to the fore. And this is the stuff, whether we're talking about, neo-Nazi rallies, we're talking about Trump's rhetoric, we're talking about Google's, flash decision to fire a guy, and there's a large reason to believe that one of the reasons they did that was to curry favor with the federal government so they wouldn't be accused of hostile workplace issues. You know, what we're witnessing is the hardening of a kind of polarized rhetoric that actually represents fewer and fewer people in America, because very few people are actually like Donald Trump, and very few people are like, say, Bernie Sanders, much less more violent or violent lefties and things like that. But we need to recast, where it's not only acceptable, but it's like widely acknowledged that when we're talking about most of these issues, there's broad agreement. And it's just that we have not knitted together a coherent national identity that allows us to actually stop talking about a lot of bullshit and just get on with living our lives and creating the next businesses, creating the next social milieu that actually allows people to flourish and thrive and experiment with their lives in peaceful, powerful, forward-looking ways.
But our glorious free society still has a bunch of alt-right dudes protesting outside Google this weekend, right? I mean, just to acknowledge, I, of course, am always happy to march side by side with Nick Gillespie into the glorious libertarian utopia. But, when we talk about these controversies living in social media and maybe not permeating the broader culture, they do cross into the real world. They are going to cross into the real world again this weekend in front of the Google headquarters. And I think we should acknowledge that kind of thing isn't going to go away, and hopefully that the conversation just happens on a level below the level of the law.
I agree completely. And what I'm saying is we do need to make the reality, I think the social reality, a social media reality. You could look at kind of post-war American culture as having two broad areas of consensus or broad periods of consensus. And the one is, basically from the New Deal on, up through Reagan, there was a broad centrist consensus, which was, very much top-down. Republicans and Democrats shared this. Eisenhower and Kennedy, even Eisenhower and Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon to a degree, there was a broad consensus that we should have. And this, top-down, relatively centralized control, highly regulated interactions in both in our personal lives as well as in our commercial lives and economic lives, that gave way to a Reaganite consensus. And both of these were popular in both parties. I mean, Reagan was, he was generally in favor of free trade and deregulation, as a lot of people were. He was in favor of, a stern anti-communism, which, was broadly popular in both parties. And what has happened, I think, since the end of the Cold War, in particular, and between Bill Clinton and George Bush, George W. Bush and Obama, is that we have not seen a consensus emerge that accurately reflects where Americans are. And for me, one of the problems with it is that I think that post-war consensus, the belief in elites and in experts, the best and the brightest, running the Vietnam War, running General Motors, running every aspect of our workplace through things, various regulatory agencies from OSHA to the EPA to the EEOC and all of that kind of stuff, that was a bad consensus that didn't last very long and couldn't last very long. The Reaganite consensus also had problems because it wanted to deregulate kind of economic life, but not cultural life. And now we're just in this place where, Bill Clinton was memorable because he could not win a majority as president, even though when he ran for re-election, he was running against Bob Dole. He was broadly popular, and he still couldn't get to 50%, which is pretty stunning. George Bush, barely got in the first place. And I'm not saying that was illegitimate or anything. I'm just saying, like, it shows that we have been driving down kind of the center of American life. Exactly at a point when it's finally where it should be, where people are relatively tolerant, they're not sexist, they're not racist. The institutions of American life are actually pretty open, or the masses of Americans are open to immigration, they're open to free trade, and they're tolerant. And yet we don't have a consensus that upholds that, and instead you have on the Democratic side, you have a kind of extreme and increasingly extreme version of identity politics. On the right, you have a different version of identity politics, which is monoethnic and monosexual, actually, or monogendered. And that's not where most of us are. So, Catherine, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just saying, I think this is part of reasons, kind of mission is to actually give a voice to the vast majority of people who are just like, look, you know, we're in a good place. We've grown up as a society. We're willing to legalize pot. We're willing to stop worrying about people's sexual practices. We want to get on with our lives. We also want the EPA to pull back a bit. We want the FDA to give us more freedom to experiment with drugs and to do things, you know, to create our lives. And business-wise, things are actually going pretty well. You know, women have never had it easier. I don't want to say easier in the workplace, but they've never had a fuller investment in the workplace. Innovation is happening. And, you know, we need to make that identity where you can be all of these things, I think, the default setting for the 21st century if we want to have a future that's worth living through.
Well, I think I would at least fall into the category, Nick, of the sort of displaced moderate that you're mentioning. I view myself as a moderate and libertarian simultaneously and do not see any contradiction in terms there. And for me, part of it is I don't really fit in either of those parties. I do hail with a classical liberal outlook and philosophy, but I don't see myself as a firebrand or anything like that. I suspect that there are quite a lot of other people that are kind of friendly people in the middle that don't really fit on either end. And I'm glad that you're optimistic about everything that's going on. That optimism is, I think, well placed, but also tumbles a lot periodically, depending on what's happening. Over on Friday, I believe, we had a tumble in the markets in terms of optimism by the tune of about $1 trillion from the possibility of nuclear warfare erupting between the United States and North Korea. That rhetoric's been going on for at least a week now, where Kim Jong-un will say something, Trump will apparently respond off the fly. And on Friday, he said military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely. And that was in response to North Korea threatening to nuke Guam as they go on here. So there's a lot to unpack. Peter, when it comes to Trump and foreign policy, is he just incapable of talking about anything without bombast, or is talking tough an actual foreign policy strategy that he's trying to employ?
I think it's pretty telling that Trump's advisors, his national security advisors, have consistently tried to downplay the commander-in-chief's remarks here. And, you know, and so you see this kind of repeated scenario in which Trump says something tough and his advisors are like, well, we didn't really mean that. It's not that big a deal. And then Trump comes back the next morning and is like, oh, I really, really meant that. And, you know, so in some sense, the instability here is being caused by the fact that we have a commander-in-chief, a president who is inexperienced, who is a braggart, who is somebody who really does not, who really kind of takes to sort of throwing his weight around, at least rhetorically. And that sort of thing just does amp up tensions on the international scene. Now, the good news is, I think, that there's not a huge amount of actual action underneath this. The plans that Trump referred to as being locked and loaded are the plans that have always been in place, not something that was put in place this week as tensions between the U.S. and North Korea have kind of heated up just a little bit. And so, you know, the hope is that serious and responsible people are basically taking care of this. And this is just a sort of dumb war of words between Trump and between North Korea. But I do think that there is some reason to worry about Trump's inexperience and about his willingness to just sort of take everything to the level of conflict and the level of, I'm the bigger man and I'm the tougher guy in basically every circumstance. And in the end, it is Trump's decision whether or not to go to war and whether or not to strike. And that should probably worry us a little bit, given both his experience level and the kinds of things that we see he is willing to say.
Nick, from what I can glean with Trump's foreign policy during the campaign, at least, it was somewhat incoherent, but it seemed to be that he was preaching a non-interventionist policy, at the same time really bumping up the amount of military spending and perceived martial greatness of the United States. Do you think he's likely to stay that course, or do you think he's going to respond with actual strikes on North Korea?
To as a starting point, let's remember that it's actually Congress's decision to go to war. It's not the president's, and unfortunately, that basic constitutional fact hasn't been enforced since World War II, and it's a problem. And this is a moment to harken back to Jeff Flake, the Arizona senator, as well as other people like Mike Lee and Rand Paul and a number of other libertarian-leaning congressmen who have said it is time for the Republican Party to step up and time for Congress to step up and assert its role really as the first branch among equals in the federal government. You know, we need a Congress that actually does what it's supposed to do, which also means passing budgets and things like that. And they've, you know, Congress has been out to lunch for a long time, and really for decades when you start to look into it in many, many important ways. So, that's my first response is, yeah, let's if we're going to war, let's for a change, let's have Congress get involved in this in a proactive way rather than in a, you know, just a way where they sign on after the fact, assuming that things don't go horribly bad. Trump is incoherent on foreign policy. He was during the campaign. He was never quite a peacenik. He was critical and rightly critical of both Obama's wars as well as George Bush's wars before that. And, that was a good thing. And I think a number of libertarians projected onto him some kind of non-interventionism that simply isn't there. It's clear that Trump is willing to intervene. He was willing to bomb a Syrian airstrip for humanitarian grounds, which he said he wouldn't specifically be doing. I don't worry about North Korea. I think North Korea is ultimately a regional threat, and that it's ultimately it's up to China. North Korea is essentially a client state of China. They can flip the switch, and I imagine one extension cord going in from China into North Korea that carries all of the minimal electricity that's seen in that country. They can step in whenever they want. I also think that between Trump's response to Charlottesville. But also the way that he was talking that Peter, I think, summarized totally accurately. The Pentagon is not going to put up with a mad bomber in chief if he's talking about nuclear weapons and things like that, which I don't think. I think this is all bluster. And we keep forgetting, it seems, every time North Korea starts rattling its sabers, everybody goes into DEFCON. Whatever, and in fact, I think this is just for show.
Catherine, on a scale of 1 to 10, how scared are you of possible nuclear warfare?
You know, ironically, a lot of our discussion today and over the weekend has been about whether or not speech is violence. And there's one case where speech is violence. This idea of a speech act, which linguists like to talk about. If President Trump says, let's bomb the shit out of North Korea, that gets pretty close to a speech act,
can you clarify what a speech act is? I'm unfamiliar with that term.
Sure. So it's just a sort of philosophical concept or a concept in linguistics. It's words that are themselves actions, right? Words that that spur physical changes in the world. And this is something that people want Nazi rhetoric to be. When people say speech is violence, they're sort of playing on this idea. But when a commander in chief says attack now, that speech is violence. And, you know, when we have people in the DMZ, U.S. forces stationed in the DMZ, whose motto is be ready to fight tonight, he is right to say that they are locked and loaded, that they are ready to go. And of course, it is true that Congress should be the entity that declares war, but we are right now relying on a sort of informal barrier of a bunch of generals to stop that war from happening. I think that barrier is effective, but it doesn't mean, I'm not laying awake nights.
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'm a 10 or 11 terrified of actual nuclear war. Of this particular situation, I think the number is somewhat lower.
Yeah, I think we should all be kind of a little bit apprehensive in general. There's been this sort of idea since the conclusion of the Cold War that everything's great now, but there's still a lot. There's enough nuclear missiles in general.
Wait, I'm sorry, but did you miss? That was true from, I think, 91 to about 2001, but it's kind of fallen into the abyss that is the 21st century, don't you think, Andrew?
Do you
Why, Nick? What happened in 2001? I can't think of what you could be referring to.
Yeah,
I meant, Nick, was I think that there's still a there is still the prospect of nuclear warfare and an unsettling amount of missiles that exist between Russia and the United States, and we're even though we appear to be in a good position right now, I am bothered by the sheer amount and existence of them. I'm not that worried about North Korea. I think North Korea, probably the reason they're citing Guam is because they don't really have the ability to directly attack the United States, although of course a nuclear missile attacking anywhere would be absolutely terrible. I'm curious, one of the stories that I saw earlier today was that the markets had tanked that I mentioned by $1 trillion for fear that there would be a conflict between North Korea and the United States. And my initial thought was, well, in the event of nuclear war, we wouldn't really be able to handle much with our index funds, right? But I suppose that because it's a because it is a possible regional thing, that's why the markets thought that you could recoup by investing in other things, Nick?
I don't know. I also want to take issue with the idea that the markets tanked because of this, that, or the other thing. If you have something like, the Great Depression, if you have something like Germany invading Poland, you can probably reliably say this or that. Markets are mercurial, and it's always a bad idea to kind of personalize them or personify them as doing this or that in response to one single thing, because most of the time I think it's much more multifactorial. I don't think, in terms of, why markets go up and down, there is also a lot of reasons to believe that we've been inflating another bubble since pretty much the last one popped and things like that. So I don't think you should ever worry about a one particular, moment up or down in the market in general.
And Catherine, to go back to North Korean rhetoric, there's a lot of saber rattling. This has gone on for some time. Is the sort of outward hostility that Kim Jong-un is projecting, is that a tactical thing in order to bolster his support with his people? Is he doing that to try and make more noise and get a better position in negotiations with the United Nations, or is he just a petulant leader?
Why not all of the above? I think it's if I'm the leader of a continually failing totalitarian state who has been scapegoating the United States for along with his father and grandfather for decades, and then the United States elects Donald Trump, that's a great day, right? That really is a lot of good rhetorical opportunity for you as the leader of North Korea. And I think he's exploiting that. In the past, when North Korea said stupid stuff about how they were going to kill us all, American presidents by and large managed to sort of say, sure, pal, sure, and maybe bulk up our defenses quietly, but not answer taunts with taunts. This is what they want. They want for the United States and for the United States president to treat North Korea as a legitimate enemy and as a player, rather than as a sad, benighted, and basically backward state.
Which it is, and hopefully it is all rhetorical. Hopefully nothing will happen involving missiles of any type. And hopefully Nick's earlier projection of American optimism will prove to be true this week as we look at rallies and protests they're having around the country, that they won't be violent, that out of them some good discourse will happen, as we had here today on the Reason podcast. So, guys, thank you for joining us, and at home, thank you for listening.